Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Today's guest is Naomi Regan. Naomi is a certified leadership coach, people and culture strategist, and co-founder of Cape People Development. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here. And today's big question is all about shifting from being experts to leaders. And there was an article that really jumped out to us about this topic, where 82% of workers entering management positions have not had any formal management training or leadership training. And we think that that's definitely an ongoing theme for people in business at the moment. So over to you, Naomi. Tell us a little bit about you, Cape, and the work that you do.
And I'll dive into, because that article was really interesting as well. So I'll maybe come back to that in a moment. But yeah, I co-founded a people development business where we predominantly work with founder and owner-led leaders, helping them shift from doing everything themselves to building thriving teams that can run without them, really. And in the process, scaling and growing as a result of getting that people side of their business right. I was in a former career an engineer, so I feel this topic really personally as well, because I very much experienced that shift from being an expert to a leader, and that kind of got me into what I'm doing now, actually. In terms of that article, it didn't surprise me at all. If anything, I think it's probably underestimating, because what it's not doing is looking at the 18% that perhaps do have some kind of training, whether that training really hits the mark and does what it needs to do to support that transition. I was actually really pleased to have that attention-grabbing stat out there, but it does bring a lot of focus to something we should be massively concerned about, something that isn't new and something that I don't think we've ever really cracked, and continues to be a challenge.
So why does it matter? Like, if I look at that stat, okay, 82% of managers have no formal leadership training. If I were to respond to that with, yeah, but they'll just figure it out when they get there. Once they have to lead, they'll learn to lead. Is that not happening, in your opinion?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, another bit of research that really speaks to why this matters so much is that it was found that somebody's line manager, leader, whatever phrase we want to use, has more impact on their mental health than a doctor, a therapist, their partner or spouse. You know, the way that people are made to feel at work and the way that they're led has a significant impact. Yes, of course, for businesses on how productive they are, how well engaged, like, how much of themselves they'll give, so therefore how well they perform. But it also matters at home as well. Shall I tell you a little bit about my personal experience into this? And then, you know, I was an engineer. I used to manage big projects, brownfield remediation. I was brownfield remediation young person of the year 2010, which is, wow, the biggest accolade I think in my career at the time. But it was, what the reason I say that is I was incredibly proud of that award, because it's something that you, as an expert, you either train for a long time, you hone your skill set, you become really skilled at doing the doing, and then you get to a point where you're successful at that. And so somebody says to you, actually, can you just lead this team of people to do the same thing as you? And for me, I was driven and ambitious, and you kind of naturally go, oh yeah, that's the next step. That's the next step that I need to take. So you do it. And that point in my career, and actually each of the different step ups that I took throughout my career, those were the toughest points. I think there's something that we don't recognize, which is that there's something really deeply personal about our identity at work and how our role impacts our identity at work. And I think if we don't recognise that, then we risk trying to cling on to parts of that. So as a, you know, working with the founders that I work with, there is a similar thing, but actually in quite a different way. They have probably built a product or a service that's been their baby, that's been, you know, they've been obsessed about, to be able to get it to the point that they've got it to where it has, that, you know, that's, it's a business that still exists and that it's growing. To be able to move away into what's then required of them as a leader means letting go of some of that. And I work with many, many leaders of founder and owner-led organizations or elsewhere who, they are deeply frustrated, but also their teams are deeply frustrated with them because they are just stuck in the weeds of the day to day. And part of that is because I think if we don't acknowledge that there is an identity shift needed to move from expert to leader, then we don't let go of what we need gave us success here and won't give us success here. We need to shift how we look at that role. And if we don't do that, then we risk kind of clinging on to what we used to do and that not, you know, working either.
And 82% is a big number.
Like, yeah.
A really big number. And I know it's, you know, it's 18 months since the article was written. I don't really think times have shifted. Nothing's moved.
No.
You know, quickly since then. Why do you think that happens? Why is it a step that's so often overlooked?
I think we assume that when someone's successful at something, that they're going to naturally just be successful in the next thing. I think we assume that being good at the detail and having all of the knowledge to be an expert will naturally translate into being a good leader. And I think what we don't recognize, one is that what worked there isn't going to work. If anything, you need the exact opposite approach. You need to be able to step away from having all of the answers, knowing all of the detail, making all of the decisions, to helping others to do that. And again, you know, a bit of a generic leadership phrase, but creating the conditions for others to be able to do that, which is the, you know, almost the polar opposite of what worked in an expert role. So there's a real shift in skill set needed, one, but more importantly than that, I think a real shift in mindset. When we're in organizations and we see high performers, we go, that's our talent. That person needs to be promoted because they're really good at the thing that they're doing. We don't assess and think about what skills and attributes, behaviors, do they need to do the next role? And that's very different. And for me, I think, and I can do this now with hindsight, but I think there's something about the main shift being, how do I add value in this role? I knew as an expert, as a technical expert, how I added value. It was very tangible. It was about delivery. It was about getting projects delivered on time, under budget. That was tangible. As a leader, no one had sat me down and I didn't, you know, actually preemptively think about, how do I add value here? The way that, you know, I work with leaders, and that doesn't just mean first-time leaders at all, because I think when you shift into a bigger leadership role or you move from an operational leader to a strategic leader, is to think about, how do we reframe what good looks like or how you add value in this role?
Yeah. I mean, I look back to the beginning of my career when I started to manage people. There was no training when I was at like an exec sort of junior management role. But then it was when I went into a bigger corporate and I was hired in as a manager and had a 12-month management and leadership training course that was brilliant. Now that I've gone through that and looking back at it, that business had a middle manager problem, right? There was tons of middle managers, loads of people who've been promoted to managers but didn't manage anyone. They've been promoted because they're good at their job, but then they've either got a manager title and didn't manage anybody or did inherit a team and were not good managers. So they went through quite a big exercise to redefine what that promotion looked like. And I look back at that now and I'm like, oh my God, that was brilliant, because it was it was giving people the recognition that they truly well deserved through that promotion, but not having to go into that management bit, because this is the point, right? How do you actually be a great manager? And it's not the skills that you have for being great at your day job.
Yeah, and I think that was it's such a great point, and it's something that in my kind of corporate role before I moved into what I do now, I was really passionate about, and we did quite a lot of work on, was how can you create pathways, for want of a better word, for people that don't just have the only option being to lead people. Because I think that's another of the big challenges, is that in a lot of organizations and businesses, the natural next step is to leadership. And if we go back to the point that I made before about identity, whilst there's something deeply personal about shifting from an expert to a leader, there's also something inherently embedded in us around, to be successful, we need to kind of grow up the career ladder, and therefore we have to become a manager and a leader. And some people, I'm not suggesting that it isn't a skill set or a mindset shift that we can make, because I think we can. I think we can make it. It takes intentionality, but it's not for everybody, and it shouldn't be the only way that we define success in a career. And actually, you know, some people they are much more stretched and effective if we work with them to find what's going to work best for them. I think it opens up, though, I think a whole other area of important thinking, which is around, like, what do we mean by leadership, like to move from an expert to leader? And I think one of the other challenges in this is that we really overcomplicate what it means to be a leader as well. And I think that then almost does restrict some people to thinking, I don't want to be a leader, or and maybe doesn't make that choice or that option open. So I think we focus a lot on big training programs, on lots of theory and frameworks and models, all of which are kind of, you know, quite overwhelming. I look to my side and the amount of books that I've got and the amount of books that exist on this topic. But actually, leadership isn't, for me, about big gestures, big actions. Leadership's about being more human, and it's about day-to-day interactions. It's about being really clear, not making assumptions about what's expected. It's about being kind as opposed to being nice. It's about being honest and choosing honesty over keeping harmony. It's about listening more. It's about asking questions. It's about being in the moment with people, and it's about not avoiding the stuff that needs to be said. It's all about day-to-day conversations and day-to-day interactions, and that's what we really focus in on. Let's stop overcomplicating, and almost in some ways let's stop traditional leadership development, and let's think about how can we have better conversations. And I think we need to help that shift from expert to leader. I think we not only have to help that person shift their mindset and and think about how they succeed in that next stage of their career, but we also need to be a lot clearer around, again, I use that phrase, what does good look like, but what it really means to be a leader. Because we might send them on a training course where they're bombarded with lots of theory, and that then is like, how do I hold all of this? How do I do all of this? If we break it down to what it is at its core, it's being a human being with another human being and getting the best out of that person through day-to-day consistent interactions.
Yeah, and I assume that that can take many different forms, right? We're sort of pitting in this conversation experts versus leaders, although I assume those things aren't mutually exclusive, right? Like, you can be a leader who's slightly different from a person with a lot of sort of natural human skills. Maybe if you're a very technical expert, you might not necessarily have those human skills as developed or as at the surface as somebody who's maybe been naturally pulled towards a career that's more human focused or people focused. Assume that you can find ways, and what you're talking about, very simple ways often, of remaining a technical expert, but also bringing in some of those kind of leadership characteristics that can help you be successful in both ways. It's not an either or, correct?
Yeah. No, completely. Of course, it's not either or. And I think it's about, and you know, I do listen to your podcast, and I was saying at the beginning that I listened back to Simon Lam's podcast, the second one that you did with him, and I think you posed a question at the end that you said, oh, you know, we'll pick this topic up again, how to be more human as a leader. I think that's the thing. You can be still an expert, and you know, there's some organizations which will massively require you to be a leader and still a highly technical expert, but it's how can we bring more humanity to that as well in terms of how we interact, because our role is to, as a leader, get the best out of people. It's to help people that work within our teams do their best work, deliver their best outputs. And so we can't do that without interacting at a human-to-human level.
You gave some really good practical advice earlier, you know, really broke it down. Where do you start? If you're an individual, let's move away from the organization for the moment. If you're an individual thinking, right, I need to up my game here, where do you start?
So conversations are the work of leadership. And that might sound really simplistic because we have conversations every single day. You know, but it's what do we do in those conversations? What role do we take? What assumptions are we making? So what we do with almost every, you know, leader or team that we work with is we break that down into the most simple terms of we have a choice. We can be directive or we can be non-directive. When we're directive, we're doing a lot of telling, instructing, directing. When we're in a non-directive space, we're opening up space for the other person to do more of the thinking. Now, within that, two ends of that spectrum, there's a lot of options that we've got and things that we can do. And what we do is we work with people to think about how can you do a bit more in that non-directive bit. And I use that phrase non-directive. Other people, you know, you might hear it as coaching or mentoring. I always use this analogy of a hot potato, right? So my co-founder, Lindsay, will be listening to this, like rolling her eyes, thinking, oh my God, she's rolled it out again. But it's my favorite analogy because it's like, so it comes from school time game where you throw a ball to each other and whoever was left holding it would be left holding the hot potato. So I almost think about responsibility as a tangible thing. And so who is holding that responsibility in the conversation? Is that me as a leader or is that the person that I'm working with? And that's important because our role as a leader is to help other people take ownership and get stuff done. But what we do invariably is every time we have a conversation, we grab that hot potato, we sit with it, we hold it, and then we kind of get frustrated that that other person's not kind of stepping up and doing what we need them to do. So if I go back to your original question around where do we start, my advice is always let's build that muscle of being able to do some of the stuff that's at the opposite end of the telling, of the instructing. Let's build the muscle and the skill set and the confidence in doing a bit more that can keep that hot potato with the other person. Because by doing that, we have that opportunity then to be able to bring that in a bit more to conversations. Because it really is all about who is doing the work, holding the responsibility and therefore taking ownership. You know, I do this day in, day out. I work as an executive coach as well. And even, you know, in the conversations that I have with people, I'm still always pulled to want to offer an answer, want to offer advice, because there's something really validating about showing what you know. There's something really validating about demonstrating the value that you add. But what are we then taking away from that other person? If we're doing the work, then they're not. and they're also not learning how to.
Yeah. I'm curious about the wider organizational responsibility for this beyond just providing leaders with support around development. We all default to more directive leadership styles when we're under pressure.
Yep.
Right. So when there are huge stresses and pressures around performance or returns, then we're much more likely to grab that hot potato, to use your analogy, and to just do the work ourselves. Right. We don't have time, space, et cetera, to actually do the hard work, often uncomfortable work, of actual leadership, supporting, mentoring, coaching. So what would you like to see from organizations in terms of creating a context where this type of leadership is possible?
So I think the first thing to say is that what I'm not suggesting is that we should always be in that non-directive space or always keeping the hot potato where it needs to be. I think we just need to be able to develop that muscle so that we can do that some of the time. And I think sometimes we do have to be intentional about being directive. Our workplaces and like all the things that you just said, Alice, require us to do that. But it's being a bit more conscious, knowing that there will be times when we have the opportunity to do a bit more in the other side, if we think about this spectrum. Going back to your point around responsibility organizations have, I think there's something about and focusing early. These skills and these kinds of shifts in mindset around conversations can happen at all levels. We talk quite a lot around leadership at all levels. Why can't these behaviors be a bit more embedded in terms of how everybody works, as opposed to just because you've got a team? I think that the other thing that the organizations can do is stop focusing so much on the knowledge that people need to gain and think more about the behaviors. So we talk a lot around knowledge, skills, and behaviors. You know, the theory that someone needs, the practical ways of putting it into practice, but actually the behaviors that they need to demonstrate to make that happen, and the training or development or support needs to focus on behaviors. You know, a lot of organizations, not most, but a lot, have maybe some values that they live by, and they might be on a wall somewhere, but it's like, having conversations about bringing those to life, what behaviors do we need to demonstrate to show that we're living this value? What do these values look like in practice? What are the expectations? Rather than them just being an outward facing tool to talk to their clients and customers and be out in the world, it's like, how can we use that internally to really talk about what this means in practice, to bring to life in a tangible way what the expectations are, or how, you know, what it looks like to demonstrate them. There is something about and role modeling talking about struggles, because I think we also believe that, or I know I did very much so, that the things I was struggling as I moved into different levels of leadership roles were my own doing. There was some way that I wasn't good enough, maybe. It isn't something that's openly talked about. And therefore, when it's not openly talked about, we internalize it, don't we? We make it more about ourselves and how good we are at that thing, as opposed to it being a very natural phase of learning. So I use this, I use a very simple visual, some people call it ladder of learning, ladder of competence, ladder of learning. And at the very bottom step rung of the ladder is that unconscious incompetence. So I don't really like the language, but, you know, we don't know what we don't know, all the way up to unconscious competence. We do it without having to think about it. And in the middle, there's two stages. So there's conscious incompetence. We suddenly realize the things that we now need to do that don't feel comfortable. And there's conscious competence, which is we're getting more practice and we're able to do it, feel more comfortable in doing it. It requires less effort, but it still requires effort. And in those two stages in the middle, if we think about this ladder, those two rungs in the middle, that's where the discomfort of learning comes in. That's where things feel sticky and hard. But our human tendency, our natural pull, is to go straight from realizing we don't know something to wanting to be able to do it without having to put any effort in or having to think about it. And we often translate that bit in the middle to mean that we're not good enough. We're maybe not cut out for this. And we internalize that. Let's talk about that more. Let's talk about the discomfort of doing new things more, so that that can then become a lot more commonplace. I'm struggling for the word, but accepted maybe that that's what happens.
So I understand that you are in the process of writing a book or publishing a book on conversations.
Yes, we are.
Is that right? What's it called?
Put that out in the world. So we're writing a book. It's working title even. It's called Beyond the Small Talk. And it's all about the conversations that we really need to have. What actually happens in these moments of human-to-human interaction that make work work?
Can you describe what some of those conversations that you might have just in the course of your daily work that you might be able to use to better influence your leadership role or to exert your leadership role in a positive way?
Yes, of course. So we talk about five main conversations, and one of those being the foundation to everything else, those conversations that we have for connection. How do we create that connection with people in our teams? And sometimes these fall in the bucket of fluffy and nice and just a bit superfluous. But actually, to be able to have any of the other conversations, we have to create that foundation of trust. So we talk a lot about, you know, balancing support and challenge. To be able to amp up the challenge that we bring, we also have to have that level of support as well. So what are those just day to day that allow people to feel seen and heard and valued? I think there's also something about, you know, we talk around some of the big conversations. People's radar will be when something doesn't go to plan and we have to have really difficult conversations. But what about those day-to-day or maybe week-to-week conversations that make sure that we're all aligned on the same outcome? So I think all too often we might set people off on a task and it makes perfect sense in our heads. No one's really said anything, asked any questions. So we just assume that it makes perfect sense in their heads. And then we get further down the line and the output's not quite what we expected. How can we get rid of some of those assumptions and actually just have more conversations about just making sure that everyone's aligned? So we call these conversations for clarity and alignment. Just those regular, just check-ins on how things are working and where people are at. And then we talk about the big conversations for giving people feedback when maybe things haven't gone to plan. What about the conversations when things really are going to plan? So what about those positive reinforcements? And again, sometimes these fall into that too fluffy box, or people know when they're doing a good job. Why do I need to tell them? They don't necessarily. And what we mean by positive reinforcement isn't great work, pat on the back. It's, do you know what I really valued from that? Do you know what I really appreciated from that? Do you know what the impact of that was? So that that can be repeated, because that's what our aim is, right? To make sure that behavior is repeated and maybe implemented or used elsewhere.
There was a video on LinkedIn a few years ago of an example of somebody delivering the shit sandwich, right? So this is really good about you. I'm going to give you a piece of bad feedback now. But also this bit's really, really great, right? And the person just doesn't hear the bit in the middle. So actually trying to almost bookend constructive feedback with positive or whatever you want to call it is not the right thing to do, because the person may not hear the constructive part. And it takes practice. It is bloody hard. And stumble your way around it with a peer or a coach or somebody first before you then go and have that with the colleague or the teammate. It's a muscle to deliver it well and make sure what you want to be heard is heard.
Yeah. In those moments of giving feedback, often our focus is all about what do I have to say? But actually, that's the starting point. The focus in that conversation is what do we both together do next as a result? And we get really hung up on what message do I want to deliver? You know, I always say, like, your role in that is to get the thing on the table so you can both stand together and look at it and think about what you do next. And so, you know, how do we do that well in a brain-friendly way? You know, that sandwich is always makes me smile because I always think about the analogy. You know, I always have this image in my head, depending on the individual in question and the leader in question, that sandwich is either really chunky bits of, like, you know, loaf of bread with a tiny bit of filling, or it's like really, really thin for someone who's trying to give up bread with this massive filling in the middle. And either way, it's just really confused. So how do we communicate in a human way, in an honest way? How do we make sure that we're being kind as opposed to being nice? Mm-hmm. How do we prioritize what the kindest thing to do? A model we love by Kim Scott called Radical Candor. And she talks about caring personally and challenging directly. How can we hold both of those? It's another way of saying, how can we bring support and challenge? But how can we care about that person and how they're going to hear this and the environment in which we say it, but also not shy away from saying the thing that really needs to be said? Because sometimes being direct is the kindest thing that we can do.
So I think what you're describing here is a model of leadership that many of us would agree is the right one, right? Yeah. That there's a sort of general set of behaviors and skills that leaders should have in order to be successful. And the data largely proves that that is actually a successful model, right? Because companies perform better and so on. But I think when we look around right now, we're seeing a lot of examples, high profile examples of the opposite kind of leadership. So very directive, very forceful, very authoritative, and not human, I would argue. And I guess I'm wondering what you're seeing on the ground in organizations. Are you feeling like there's a shift or a kind of backlash against some of that more vulnerable, open human leadership? Or is it just that the high profile stuff gets attention and actually people within businesses and organizations these days are continuing to develop those leadership skills in a positive way?
So I think it's there's a mix. I think there was, I think there's something about, I'll go back again. I feel like I'm kind of, you know, I'm like some, you know, fangirl repeating back some of the things from previous podcasts. But there was something in one of your recent podcasts where it said, when we go into protection mode, we're less likely to achieve the outcomes that we're looking to achieve. So I think what we have to layer into this is that we can get all of the reasons why more of a human approach to leadership works. That all makes sense, you know, theoretically. But when it comes to it and we're up against it and we're having to deliver things or things aren't going to plan, we default often to what we're socially conditioned to do. And I think that means that what we know works and what we actually do is often quite a different thing. Mm-hmm. There's a great book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? And it's not a book about men. It's written by a man. It's not saying that the men are incompetent in any way, but it's talking about, and it talks about women in this as well, that some of the attributes we look for when we promote people or when we bring people into organizations at a more senior level are the attributes that then go against what we actually need from him in that role. So we're weighing up a couple of candidates in an interview for an exec team role. And we've got somebody who is, you know, very direct and forceful and confident. And that might in that moment give us confidence that that person's got hold of this and is going to be a safe pair of hands. And somebody who maybe is a bit more reflective and perhaps, you know, just doesn't fit that stereotypical mold, we might have more caution about when actually we think about what role we want them to do. And there's just some really great examples of how unconscious bias plays out when we're thinking about leadership mm-hmm. roles and that difference between what we actually need from those roles as well.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And actually, it's a good transition to wrap up the episode today. That is a great directive, I think, for organizations in terms of how they look at people that they're considering promoting into leadership roles to be a little more expansive in their thinking around what constitutes yeah. a good leader. Are there other suggestions that you would give to organizations in order to, encourage them to build the kind of leadership they need for the future.
So I think we've talked about some of this already. So if I just come back to some of the kind of key points, I think being really, really clear on what it means to be a leader in this organization. And that isn't just one size fits all. So if you've got a set of values, that's a great place to start. Often your values are outward looking. And I've worked with companies, and I'm working with a charity at the moment actually as well, who is the values are all about the families that they support, which are just the fabulous, but the people who work for that charity don't actually look at and think about how they use those values internally. So how can we use our values and bring those to life for people to help demonstrate what it means to be a leader in your organization? Really, really get under the skin of that and build that out in as practical and tangible a way and involve people in that. I think it's because it is all about the behaviours. Creating space to make it okay to talk about. And I know there's something, you know, there's a tension here, and I'm not saying we should always be talking about, you know, where it's gone wrong, not at all. But actually making it a bit more open that struggle in the middle of learning and that discomfort that comes with trying things out and just stopping assuming that people know how to lead and that what gives somebody success in one role is automatically going to translate. Because if we're perpetuating that, then we're almost setting that as the benchmark that, okay, well, I'm getting promoted because I'm good in this role, therefore I better keep doing that and doing that even more. So really helping to shift that thinking around, we're promoting you because these behaviors and helping to have those conversations around what's going to need to be done, what does success look like in another role as well.
And what do individuals need to do to ensure that they are in a position to move into a leadership position at some point or to improve where they're currently sitting within leadership?
So I think, firstly, this isn't about assuming you have to be a completely different person. Actually, how can you connect more with who you are as a person and bring that more? And really thinking about what are the maybe some of the beliefs, they might be quite kind of hidden away, but what are some of the beliefs that I'm bringing into this role or that I think is going to be needed in the next role and challenging some of those. So is my belief that people are going to come to me and the way I demonstrate my authority is giving them the answers, or is actually that belief helpful? Because it probably isn't going to be helpful. So really challenging some of those beliefs that we might have and shifting our mindset and having the conversations. Yeah. Having the conversations, that work of leadership.
Just one more quick thing. So the future prognosis suggests that we as leaders will be managing teams that blend human beings and AI agents. So I guess, do you have any thoughts on what that then, what the implications are then of that in terms of leadership styles?
Yeah, great question. There's getting stuff done. There's the task management stuff, but then there's the human to human interaction. And if anything, that leadership, you know, that what everything that we've talked about is the thing that sets us apart from AI, the thing that we can't replicate. And so if anything, it becomes even more important to hone that and to get skilled at that and to get skilled at it, you know, to hone that and to, you know, practice that and value that.
100%. That's a great answer. And I think we'll give people hope too, that it's not all just about corralling AI agents. So how can people find out more about you?
You can visit us on our website, Kate People Development, or find us on LinkedIn. And yeah, we're always open to chatting and supporting founders, predominantly founders and owner-led organizations, to get the people side of your business kind of in line with where you want to go.
Great. And when's the book coming out?
So we've just, this is all hot off the press, putting it out in the world. No, we've literally just pressed the button this week, end of last week, with our publisher. So now we're in the chain of that. So first draft is to be submitted. I'm about to hand it over this in a couple of weeks' time, and then it goes into the chain of that, so early next year.
Great, really exciting.
Good
luck with that.
Good luck. And we will, you referenced some really great books in there, so we will drop your links, but also some mentions of the books into the show notes too. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.